What's up, guys? Rachel Lindsay here, and I am teaming up with your favorite Ringer podcasters to deliver the Bravo drama and news that you've been craving on Morally Corrupt. It's the show about all things Bravo, from the Housewives to Summer House and everything in between. We'll be mentioning it all every week. Check it out on Spotify and theringer.com.
Hey everybody, it's Larry Wilmore, and you're listening to Black on the Air. Thanks for tuning in the podcast. Really appreciate it. I'm kind of on the road this week. I've been in New York promoting the film that I'm in, and I'm in Santa Barbara right now, California, just for a couple of days, a little R&R. Sitting outside right now, it's really nice, very beautiful. Painting the picture for you guys. And guess what, you guys? I have not watched the news this week, so I'm not doing a weighty weigh-in this week. I'm doing a happy weigh-in. Because I have no opinion on what's going on. Guys, let me tell you something. It is so nice not to watch the news and see what's going on. And, you know, just not have all that crap in your head. But I will be back soon with the weigh-in. I think we're going to have one more show after this, and then I'm going to take a couple weeks off. And then in mid-July or whatever, we'll come back with a slate of guests. But today I have David Franco, the director, who is the director of the movie that I've been promoting this week, Jerry and Marge Go Large. And it's on Paramount Plus, the streaming network. I was in New York promoting it, did Jimmy Fallon, if you guys caught it, on Monday. It was so much fun. You know, it's so weird. I've never been on The Tonight Show. When I was there, I couldn't believe it because, when you're a stand-up comic, that was the thing when I was starting out. You got to get on The Tonight Show and that kind of stuff. And all these years, you know, it's funny that that's the show that I've never been on. I've been on Kimmel, Colbert, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, done tons of interview shows, things like that. But it's fascinating that I found it ironic. I'd never been on the actual Tonight Show. Got a chance to talk with Jimmy before the show. You know, he was just awesome. We had ended up talking for quite a long time. They had to pull him. Jimmy, it's time to do the show, for Christ's sakes. But it was like, you know, it almost felt like we had a lot to catch up on because we know a lot of the same people, of course, and all that stuff. And I am a fan of Jimmy Fallon's. I know some people knock him a lot, but I'm a fan, man. The guy is an entertainer through and through. And by the way, has a ton of charisma in person as well as on screen. And of course, you know, The Roots is the best band in television for that late night format. But Jimmy was great. He was so sweet. And we had a lot of fun. The conversation we had before the show was so entertaining. You know, we talked about a lot of stuff and really, really laughed. But on the show was a lot of fun, too. They pulled out a picture of me on The Facts of Life. And I talked about some of my old stand-up stuff. You know, those things. For those of you that don't know how those shows go, they look like, you know, you're talking in the moment and stuff. But, of course, you do pre-interviews and they have a sense of what they want to talk about. Though the conversation can go in any direction. You know, they're just prepared for it. I didn't know until I got there they were going to put out that picture of me and The Facts of Life from years ago. But that was fun. And Tuesday, I actually did a photo shoot for New York Magazine. They're doing interview, kind of a profile, I mean, that's coming out later this summer. Something to look forward to. It was a Larry Wilmore promo week, guys. A lot of stuff going on for you, boy. And that was fun, doing a little photo shoot. Hadn't done that since I was really doing my show, you know, a while. And then Wednesday, it was the Tribeca Film Festival. Got to see where they screened Jerry and Marge in front of an audience, and man, that was so much fun. I got to finally meet the actual Jerry and Marge. Now, Jerry and Marge, the story of that movie, of course, is about the guy who beat the lottery. He didn't cheat it. He beat it. And he was in Michigan and ended up getting his whole town involved. Like, ended up winning, like, $27 million, something like that. I played the accountant, Steve Woods, in the movie. And I'll go into more detail when you're here in my conversation with David coming up. You know, we'll talk about the movie. But it was great seeing everybody there, some of the actors. Some couldn't make it, but seeing Bryan Cranston and Rainn Wilson and hanging out with some of the other people, Brad Copeland, who wrote the script, really did a great job. And I hope you guys do get a chance to see it, because it really is a fun movie. It's one of those feel-good things. And this evening, back in Los Angeles, which you can... I'm not sure when they publish it, but I'll be on the Go Fact Yourself podcast with my old pal Helen Hong, who I did a pilot with a couple years ago. And that's going to be fun. But I'm also, this, I know, I'm telling you, I'm promoting myself. This is Larry Promo Week. I was on Sean Hayes's podcast called The Hypochondriactor. I think that's the name of it. And I have a link to that in Twitter and everything, where I bring up this story when I was married and kind of had this empathic pain reaction to pregnancy. It was a real interesting story. I don't think I've ever told that story publicly, but it was so much fun doing that podcast. And I could put another link to that on my Twitter feed if you guys are interested. So look, if you're a fan of Larry Wilmore, you guys, there's a lot of stuff going on. A lot going on this week. And coming up, there's more, guys. There's more. I told you I had a lot of stuff to talk about. The Essence Festival is coming up next weekend or the weekend after. Coming up soon. For those of you going to the Essence Festival, they will be announcing the drama that I've been producing with Kerry Washington called Reasonable Doubt, created by the unbelievable Ramla Muhammad, whose name you will know soon. Ramla Muhammad is just fire, man. She's so great. So much fun to work with. So hilarious. She's a drama writer, but she's so funny. Really, really funny. Just really smart and just, you know, just a real sensitive, great artist. So Reasonable Doubt, I'm very proud of you guys, and I can't wait for you to see it. So they're going to be promoting that at the Essence Festival. I think that's the big announcement, so I won't say too much about that. I'm giving you guys pre-information. And what else? That's a preview of some of the stuff I got coming out. And by the way, guys, this is going to be a fun year, because that's just a couple of the things that's going on. There's a lot of stuff coming down the pike that I'll be sharing with you. This is going to be a fun year. Some fun projects that I'm associated with and working on and that kind of stuff. Some involving me as a performer and some just me as a producer. That type of thing. And there you go. That's what's coming up. So like I said, I haven't been watching the news this week. I assume there's stuff still going on. I assume that January 6th thing that I said is like watching an episode of Columbo. I assume that's still going on. I have no idea. Don't really care about those motherfuckers that much. But I think we have one more pod coming up next week. But I'm not sure. Don't take my word for it. And if we do, I promise you, I will give you a full wrap-up on the day's events and what's going on before I take off for a little break. But until then, please enjoy my conversation with David Frankel, the director of Jerry and Marge Go Lard, streaming on Paramount Plus. That's it. Talk to you guys soon. Thanks.
This episode is brought to you by Hyundai. What does your next drive look like? Running between meetings? Maybe a getaway with the whole family? Either way, the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the capable SUV that's built for your life. With premium interiors, available wireless charging, and room for your whole cargo and crew. Okay, Hyundai. Visit HyundaiUSA.com to learn more about the all-new 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe.
There's a lot of hypocrisy in the PGA Tour. It's like, look, niggas couldn't even play in your tour for so long. You know, how are you going to make this hypocritical, you know, oh, we can't take money for this.
It's indefensible. Absolutely. You know, and they're still playing in China. So what are the Chinese?
Oh, exactly. As the NBA is. I mean, all these things as well as their government. Anyhow, whole nother discussion. But I'll probably talk about that on my pod. Maybe I should have Alan on the show. That might be good.
I'm amazed. Like, can I just say about podcasts? Like, I listen to you. I mean, I don't understand how you get up in the morning and you can talk for 20 minutes. I just viewing your thoughts. I wish I had like 30 seconds worth of that much intelligence to be able to talk thoughtfully.
No, David. Spewing is the key word. Like okay. You just said, spewing is the key word. By the way, guys, this is nothing but I call this special guest month. you know, is what we have here. Really, this is going to be such a fun talk. I can't wait to talk to this gentleman. I had the pleasure of working with him, but have been a fan, and all of you have been a fan of his work. Director of movies like Devil Wears Prada, Marley and Me. Everything he makes is just always so good. It's just, makes you laugh, makes you cry, all of that stuff, you know. But he's coming back with a movie with an incredible cast, you guys. There's an incredible cast of this thing, which we'll talk about. Jerry and Marge Go Large, which will be streaming on Paramount Plus, I think as we speak, as this drops. And the director, David Franco. David, welcome to Black in the Air.
Great to be here, Larry. Any time with you is a great time.
It's so much fun. You know, I'm joking, but I had so much fun working with you and making this movie. It was just, it was a joy from day one to day to, and it still is. The movie is just out right now. Jerry and Marge Go Large. Let's start with the movie itself and just tell everybody about the movie. What is it? What are we going to see? And all that kind of stuff.
Jerry and Marge Go Large is the story of Jerry and Marge Selby, who figured out how to win the lottery legally. And use the proceeds to enhance the lives of their friends and the people in their small town up in Michigan. And it's a remarkable story. It's really and it's a love story. It's about these two people in their 60s who rediscover each other and the romance that is their marriage. And you play, if I may say, you are the comic center of the movie. You are the comic spine. You know, get all the big laughs, and you play their accountant, who helps them put together the corporation that they use to increase their capital, and you benefit handsomely. And along the way, there's even a nice romantic angle for your character.
Yeah, there's Bryan Cranston, Annette Bening, Rainn Wilson, Michael McKean. Such a great cast. I mean,
extraordinary cast. And, you know, Anna Camp, Jake McDormand.
Anna Camp, you know, so great. Yeah. Now, the actual thing happened like in 2003, I think.
They actually were succeeding at the lottery for the better part of 9 years.
It was 9 years? Complete.
9 years, actually. Wow. Yeah. The movie condenses it into about a year. But they actually did it for 9 years. And they started in the early 2000s and went for 9 years.
Wow. He got away with that for 9 years. Wow.
Yeah, 9 years of like every few weeks. They lived in Michigan, but they played this special game where they were guaranteed to win if they bet enough.
Yeah.
The only place to play it was in Massachusetts. So they would drive the 10 hours to Massachusetts. They would spend about 4 days printing the tickets in a convenience store, and then they would spend another 2 weeks in a motel.
Amazing.
With the curtains drawn, going through the tickets and figuring out which were winners and which were losers.
Now let's talk about this thing itself first, so people know what he did. So he was like, he worked in like a cereal factory or something like that.
Yeah, we depict him as working at Kellogg's. Yeah.
Yeah. But he was like a math whiz, like Beautiful Mind type of thing.
Yeah. You know, he dreamed of going to MIT and working in science, and that wasn't how he spent his life.
Yeah.
So, but he still had that kind of crazy math mind.
Yeah. And apparently, you know, in retirement, he was just bored and he just looked at this. I read a thing where he said he figured it out in like 3 minutes, like there was a weakness in it. I'll describe it a little bit. It's called Windfall, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, you know, you have to guess the numbers like most lotteries, but if no one wins after a few weeks or something, you don't just get a set amount for guessing 3, 4, or 5 numbers. You get more because the whole jackpot is like shared.
That's exactly how it works. Yeah, it's very complicated. In most games, you need 6 correct numbers to win the jackpot. So in this game, when the pot got over $2 million and no one had won the jackpot, then the prize money rolled down. So you would win jackpot money with 5 numbers, and you would win the 5-number prize with 4 numbers, and it rolled down like that. So once that happened, once there was a roll down, Jerry figured out that the odds turned in your favor. And if you bet enough, you had to have a large sample. So you had to bet a lot of money. But if you did, you basically guaranteed between a 20 and 30% return on your betting.
And I guess the idea is that if you don't have to guess all 6 numbers, it's easier to guess like 3, right? Is that the basic idea? Like more people theoretically will guess 3 out of 6 than will guess 6 out of 6, right? That makes sense.
For sure.
And your odds of guessing 3 and 4 are much higher. And if you buy enough tickets, a couple of them are going to have those 3 of those numbers or 4 of the numbers, right?
Yeah.
And so on the windfall weeks, I just want to make sure everybody's clear on this. You just win more for doing that. And so you cover the losses that you would make from the amount of tickets that you buy.
Yeah, you lose less, basically, and you win more.
But you still have to be putting in a lot of money to really get the benefits of it. But if you're willing to do that, it works out.
Right, you got it. We should have recorded you doing telling and put it at the end of the movie.
It's true, because even when I was making it, I go, so how does this windfall? Like, I was actually listening to him when he was explaining it to me in the diner, and I'm like, I still don't understand this, Jerry. Like, you know,
but Jerry, you know, Jerry, the real Jerry Selby can, you know, can explain it in great detail. He's a fascinating guy.
So what attracted you to the story? Like, how do you get involved? Because I mean, this story happened a while ago, so it seems like this story was the script around for a while, or was it, I think it was based on a Huffington Post article or something?
It was Huffington Post piece by Jason Fagone. And then Brad Copeland, the screenwriter, got a hold of the story and wrote this hilarious screenplay that hooked me from page one. And then my friend Gil Metter sent me the script. He had produced Marley and Me.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, would this interest you? And literally from the first page, I was hooked. And it was early in the pandemic.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And here was this happy, inspirational story about, you know, two great characters and two great roles for movie stars to play. And I want to run out and shoot it immediately. You know, yeah. This is like May of 2020. And of course, here we are 2 years later. But fortunately, we're still in a pandemic, so we still need some sort of comic relief.
It is interesting how timing, I think, plays a part in so many things and even making decisions, because it struck me reading it during the pandemic as well. You know, I even said in interviews, you know, I had already lost my brother, you know, it was a real tough time for me. And I said, look, I want to live in gratitude right now. That was the promise I made to myself last year. And when I read the script, I'm like, this is exactly what I'm talking about. You know, it's about people living with that kind of philosophy and that type of thing. You know, it would seem hard to make a movie out of something like this. Is that right? Don't you think?
I probably, when I heard the story the first time, I go, how are they going to do that? Just like, yeah, a bunch of people standing at a lottery machine. Like, where's the cinema? So, you know, kudos to Brad for figuring out that it was this great character piece. And the how of how they did it was dramatic enough that there doesn't need to be a lot of action. There's a little bit of conflict down the road. They do have some competitors. For me, it was really a love story. For me, yeah, it really a story of friendship and this romance at the heart of it. These two people finding both adventure and romance, mm-hmm, over the age of 60. I tell people I make movies for two people, you know, my wife and my dad. And my wife wants stories that make her feel good. And my dad wants stories that make him think a little bit. And this kind of hit all the targets.
And when you're looking at a script like that, are you saying, okay, I love this because it is a character piece. That's the thing that's speaking to me the most. Is that how you're looking at films these days, as opposed to, man, this story, this plot is really interesting? Like, how are you feeling your way through that?
How do I feel when I finished it? That's the key. Yes, of course, I want to be drawn in. I want to be turning pages and find out, okay, how did they do it? And what happened when they did it. But for me, it's the endings of movies that are so important. I would just want to feel like that 90 minutes or 2 hours that I spent watching that was worthwhile. I literally tell people, I want to feel, you know, my heart expand. I want to feel like it was a love affair, yeah, that, you know, for those 2 hours. And that's how I felt reading Brad's script. And then, of course, it made me laugh out loud. I mean, you know, like when you say, you know, with the calculator, that will increase your, you know, you'll make this much. Oh, right. Literally the only time I was going to get to use that today. Because, you know, you have just so many great lines.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. It was so much fun. I had a blast doing it. I couldn't believe I was acting in a movie with Bryan Cranston and Annette Bening. So for me, I was a kid in a candy shop.
But it's kind of weird. I mean, you can talk about it even more than I can. It's, they didn't seem like Bryan Cranston.
Not at all.
And Annette Bening, right? They seem like Jerry and Mark.
Absolutely.
You never felt that, oh, we have to get out, get ready, Bryan's coming, and everybody, you
yes,
know,
exactly,
getting all nervous, you know.
Right, this monster.
This guy, Jerry, just, you know, ambled onto the set. People kept talking, you know.
Yeah.
He's ready to work. They're so down to earth, you know, and that, I think that, mm-hmm, that was the thing. They were so respectful of the characters. There's no condescension in the way they played. You know, these are big city people playing small town people in, but yeah. There was absolutely no distance. And they themselves had so much chemistry, which, mm-hmm. Together, which we, immediately.
Did you guys visit the Real Selby's together, or did you do that separately?
Yeah. No, we went up together.
What was that experience like?
It was great. And they were very welcoming. Uh-huh. I was only up there for a day, but Brian and Annette spent 3 days with them. And, you know, many, many meals. You know, Jerry's a bit of a ham. He loves all the attention he's gotten from the story. And he needs to be busy with numbers. I mean, right now he's got some Major League Baseball betting scheme that he's been working on for a year.
That's awesome.
And Marge would be happy if she never saw another human being the rest of her life. I mean, she's very nice, but she's, you know, gets down to business. She needs to be busy. I said to them, would you guys travel? No, I don't need to see more people. Like, yeah. You know, there's too many people already in this town of 2,000.
Right.
So, you know, but they haven't changed their lives at all. You know, they make, mm-hmm. you know, over all those years, they made millions of dollars. And I think they bought a new truck. That was about it. It didn't distort their existence in any way.
Now, as a director, like, what are you looking to get out of a meeting like that? Because I would think some people may not want to meet the real people, you know, for whatever. So if you're meeting the real people, what are you hoping to get from that?
For me, I mean, a lot of it is just the spirit of the people, just to make sure that I'm respecting their, you know, their rhythms and their view of the world. I don't think there's anything that we mm-hmm. took that we said, oh, I learned this, let's put it in the script. I think it was more just getting a sense of them and making sure that we respected that quality, that their earnestness and the simplicity of their lives. You know, both Brian and Annette really paid very close attention. I don't think they were mimicking mm-hmm. the Selbys, but they, again, wanted to honor the spirit of who they were.
And Brian has played famous people where when you're doing a famous person, they're somewhat of an impression that is in the performance of it. I'm saying impression just to use that term, but you know what I mean? You have to present more of that person as people remember to a certain extent. But when it's someone that they don't know, all you really have to do is kind of evoke the spirit of it, which I think would be a lot freer for the actor, it would seem.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that combined with the fact that Brad, in telling the story, I mean, it is based on Jerry and Marge's story or inspired by, you know, it's right. not a literal
sure.
depiction of it. So, you know, there are a lot of liberties taken in the storytelling and even in their character biographies. But again, you know, Jerry and Marge watching the movie will mm-hmm. recognize themselves and they'll recognize the dynamic. And then the key to their relationship was that when Jerry, you know, he took the 3 minutes that it took him to discover the flaw in the lottery. And then eventually, a couple of weeks later, he revealed to Marge that mm-hmm. this is what he was doing, which was contrary, you know, playing the lottery is contrary to all previous behavior. And Marge just completely embraced the idea. She didn't even need mm-hmm. him to explain it the way we've explained it to each other. You know, she just said, oh, if you figure it out, I'm in, let's go. You know, that fact really defined their yeah. connection and the characters, both, you know, for Brian and Annette.
It's really one of the best scenes in the movie, I think, too, when she comes on board and her enthusiasm, because it really makes the movie about their relationship, as you say, too. Like, I enjoy watching them dancing in that motel and that sort of thing. I'm like, you know, it's fun to get an experience of what the movie really is while you're watching this thing of what's telling us that other thing. You know what I mean? You get a lot of just joy out of that.
Joy is exactly the right word. And that was, you know, my reaction to Brad's script. You know, that's the real challenge of all our jobs, is to make sure that we convey that joy.
Yeah.
You know, when we do our work.
Yes. So process-wise, David, as a director, where do you start with a movie like this? Because you're in the middle of COVID, you know, it's for streaming, you know, it's not a Marvel film, you know, so you're not going to have the biggest budget and that sort of thing. Where does your process start? Is it just the bare bones, just planning of how the hell am I even going to shoot this thing?
I mean, first of all, it starts with the cast. I mean, I think that's, you know, yeah. So a lot of the work, Margie Simpkin is a brilliant casting director. Without her, I might not have met you. So I'm grateful for all her insight. So, you know, putting together the cast after that, I mean, that's honestly 90% of it. And then you just need places for the cast to do their work. So, you know, we spent a lot of time mm-hmm. hunting around Atlanta for the locations and trying to vaguely simulate Michigan in Atlanta. And, you know, it's just finding the right small town, because Everett, Michigan is a tiny town. And then, yeah, we shot the movie in 30 days. which amazing. Is not a lot of days to shoot a movie.
No, it's not.
You know, going back just 15 years, I mean, or schedules of movies in those days were twice as long. Fortunately, I mean, you know, Brian especially has obviously done a lot of television. So he knows he's, you know, incredibly prepared, works quickly, and not a lot of takes. You know, you have to be cognizant of the time and the schedule at every turn. You know, we had a great director of photography. I mean, that's the other thing you have to do is put together a team of colleagues. And Maurice Alberti shot the movie beautifully. And we've worked together a lot now. Yeah. We did Inventing Anna together. We did Collateral Beauty together.
Yeah, she's awesome.
She actually shot a TV pilot I did in the mid-90s that won an Oscar for Best Short Film.
And say her name again so everybody
knows. Maurice Alberti.
Yeah, there you go, you guys. Very talented.
She worked with Denzel 2 years ago, Ron Howard a couple of years ago. She just worked with Tommy Lee Jones a few months ago. So she's the same age as Jerry, Marge, and me, and still out there, like, working her ass off. It's a real testament. And just, you know, it's great to have a woman behind the camera. You know, there's just this, she has a real eye for the emotions of the scenes. And so come to depend on her, and also great eye for the cinema and, you know, beautiful photographic sense.
Yeah. I want to talk about those types of collaborations, because I agree. Maurice, she was so much fun to talk to. You know, I was just trying to absorb just what was going on and some of that stuff too. But there's two types of collaborations. Well, there's more than two, but I'll focus on these two. There's the director DP collaboration, and there's the director star collaboration in this sense. You know, you and Brian, you and Maurice. So let's talk about you and Maurice. How much of a vision do you have for something that is either affected by maybe what she has, or is she guiding the vision and you're going, yeah, here's what I want to do. How do you see it? Like, how does that relationship work exactly?
You know, there's a real give and take. I'll come in, you know, my goal is obviously character and story, but also energy and pacing. And so I say, here's what I'm trying to accomplish here, you know, and then we're looking for locations. We find where we're going to shoot it, and she'll make suggestions on, and very often it's, you know, the opposite of what I imagined how we were going to do it.
Interesting. That's so interesting. Yeah.
You know, you walk into a house and you go, you know, I don't quite see it.
How am I going to shoot this thing?
Yeah. And she'll go, no, you know, the light over here is great. And when we paint this room and put up different wallpaper and the angles and the doorway, you know, these are the shots we can get. So yeah, DPs definitely see things in a different way. And it's always valuable. And then, you know, I rely on her, honestly, just to make people look great. That's the other thing. It's just to just be aware, especially here, it's actors of a certain age, you know, you want to make sure that the camera still loves them. And she's really attuned to that.
I always find it's great when you can find economy by having those conversations, by really talking it through, and that collaboration just magically makes something so much simpler and more beautiful at the same time. Like, yes, I love when those types of moments happen.
She's both, you know, she can be very careful with composing shots, but she also is able to work, you know, really, oh my God, we got 20 minutes. We got to shoot, you know, four pages.
Exactly. We got to do this shit. You know, I love what you just said, but we got to shoot this shit now.
Have you done it? Have you directed? Have you?
I've done some TV. One of my evil plans, I think, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, that I have a couple of ideas. There's a couple of things I want to direct that we could talk about.
No, you should. You should. And then you can, you know, that I can interview you.
Believe me, part of this interview is picking your brain on some of these things before I jump into it, you know. But I have been behind the camera before, and I love it. Let's talk about you and Brian, because how much was Brian involved in the script? And like, I know there were rewrites that happened sometimes. Are you having conversations with Brian and Brad at that point? Is it with Brian? And how does that work as you're making the film?
I mean, you know, the movie wouldn't get made without Brian's passion for playing Jerry. Right. And then from the beginning, he was very open with ideas for making small things better, going deeper.
Yeah.
And then over time, as he really got into the character and as he started playing him, things occurred to him like, oh, this, I understand why it was written this way, but I don't think Jerry would say it that way. So, and he, you know, so we bring up Brad, and, you know, fortunately, Brad was really open to, you know, Brian's thoughts, and then Brad would find a way to blend in the new ideas. And there was one specific big scene that was it's a confrontation with the bad guy in the movie. And in the scene, you know, Brian, the Jerry comes in and really lets loose and gets really angry. And Brian, a few days before we started, said, I don't know that Jerry would express all this anger. You know, Jerry isn't a guy he doesn't go to the extremes of emotion. And if he was angry, he drove all the way to Massachusetts. He would have got out of the system before he got here. So I want to play it a little quieter. I want to play it more thoughtfully. For a while, it was a little controversial. You know, there was, are we missing a bet here by not having Jerry lose his temper? And in fact, you know, it turns out that the way that, you know, the scene got remade turned out to be a favorite scene for the audiences. You know, it's just sort of a moment where it's in a Jerry-like fashion, he, you know, expresses his views. And so that, you know, that was a specific example of a scene that really got reoriented emotionally. And then of course, there were a lot of jokes and a lot of moments with, you know, I'm sure you experienced that. Well, if I say this, you say that. You know, so much of it, I think he was inspired just by spending the time with Annette too. And like, as the movie went on, his performance as Jerry loosened up a lot. And when he saw the cut, he goes, should I really say that? Or should I really look that enthusiastic? I went a little too far. No, don't worry.
It is funny because by him playing it so kind of insular or whatever, like the scene where he's kicking the book,
yeah,
it's so funny.
Yeah.
Because you see, seeing him explode actually is funny, you know, because he seems so mild-mannered.
The moment where he kicks the boat, or there are other moments, you know, where he's celebrating with a check, or, you know, Marge, you know, they get out of the game and they want to get back into the game. And he says, you know, you're batshit crazy. And, you know, Brian said, please take that out. Like, Jerry would never call Marge batshit crazy. And I go, no,
that's hilarious.
It's great. Of course. Like, he's, you know, it's nice to see him break out of the shell every once in a while. But it was interesting, his commitment to playing a guy in a shell. And that's why those moments are so exciting, is because, you know, he did commit to playing a guy who there were no highs and lows. And then when you get a few highs, it's kind of great.
Yeah. Why did you decide to make it current day as opposed to in that time period? I guess there's nothing specific about that time period that would make it have to be then, I guess.
That was the thing, you know, like I felt like there was very little that really, you know, for most people would be like, was that the iPhone 7 or the iPhone 3 that they're using? Like, you know, and then.
Oh, it's a flip phone. So you have to go far enough to make it a flip phone, and then you don't have to worry about it.
No, and then there's you know, honestly, there's an enormous cost involved to. Suddenly all the cars have to be period. You don't get any free traffic. You have to think about where people wearing the right clothes, the right signs, you know. So it was more like there's just an enormous cost involved. And it, so a lot of times if it's a period, it distances you a little bit from the story. So there didn't seem to be a downside to making a contemporary or an upside to making a period.
I'll be honest with you. This is kind of a confession. As I was making it, I had no idea what year it was.
That's because you did your work as an actor. You were completely...
Yeah. I wasn't judging the year. I was just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, which when I did the thing with the phone, I go, oh, okay, it's an iPhone. So maybe it's this year. Maybe it's last year. I mean, I don't know. But it didn't, you know, I wasn't thinking about that. You know,
if there were a roll down in Massachusetts, it could have happened now. But there just didn't seem to be a reason to make a period.
You know, you've done a lot of things that involve real stories, real people, or real events. What's the biggest challenge in doing that type of film as opposed to something completely made up?
You know, it's honoring the characters. You know, when we did Marley and Me, John Grogan had written all this autobiographical stuff and shared so much of his life. And we were, you know, really trying to capture that. But I remember when we showed the movie to him and his family, and the kids were characters in the movie, the kids were not so thrilled. Oh, that's supposed to be me? You know, so anytime you're depicted, and I, you know, look, I've had that experience. I may have showed Devil Wears Prada to Anna Wintour. You know, I thought, wow, we really pulled our punches. And then you show the movie and, you know, you understand that the real person is seeing it, and you go, ah, maybe it's pretty hard hitting. I didn't, you know, maybe there's no punches pulled at all.
Well, the people that worked with her go, I don't know if you went far.
It's always tricky. And obviously movies in every instance, you're taking enormous liberties and time gets compressed right. and character details get fudged. And, you know, these are all based on, and you have to have the nerve to sort of move away from the reality. And at the same time, really, be respectful of, you know, the spirit of the person.
How did you get started in the business, David? What got you into this?
My dad was a journalist and my mom was a writer and I wanted to be a screenwriter. Mm. You know, I took playwriting classes in college. I came out to Hollywood and I wrote screenplays at night and on weekends. And you know, eventually, like everybody's got some crazy serendipitous story, as you know, a script got to a girlfriend who gave it to an agent who gave it to another agent who gave it to a producer. The next thing I know, I had met a man who became my mentor, Norman Steinberg.
Oh,
a comedy writer.
Norman Steinberg is a legend. Yeah.
And he worked with Mel Brooks on Blazing Saddles. Absolutely. And he wrote, you know, one of my favorite movies, My Favorite Year. And so Norman and I,
one of my favorites too. Yeah. Richard Benjamin. And
we collaborated for, you know, the better part of a decade. We were writing partners and, wrote movies together produced several sitcoms together. So had a great time together. And I was just, you know, once you write a bunch of movies that don't come out the way you imagine them, and that inspires you to be a director.
Interesting.
And, you know, you just go, wait a minute, I could do this just as badly as that guy. You know, I figured out, well, how do I do this? And so I created a TV series where I directed all the episodes called The Grapevine in the 90s. And that was my first experience, you know, behind single camera. Mm-hmm. I had done some sitcoms and stuff before.
And it was really an effort to have your expression be what you wanted it to be. It was kind of a practical way that you did it. That's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, candidly, you know, my hero growing up was Woody Allen.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was just this single-minded one man, one vision. You know, as it turned out, I mean, I've been lucky enough to collaborate with a lot of great writers, and I contribute, but I don't do all the writing. But the joy for me is sort of going to the circus every day when you're making a movie. You know, it's honestly a party. You're making something joyful.
Yeah.
The act, you know, the experience of making it is joyful, and I think you felt that
absolutely
coming to our set. It's a happy place. It's a happy factory.
Yeah, I always make it play. It's work, but I make it feel like play because I know how privileged we are to be doing it and all that stuff. And it's what I want to do. You know, it's like, we should be having fun doing this. Even when, and in its most difficult times, there should be a joy that's in it. And I think if there is, it'll come through, you know, through that screen, I believe. You know, the joy that you have in making it can be infectious.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, that you and I both worked on things that people come up to us years later and go, that's part of whatever that thing is that came out of your head. It's also part of my imagination, my shared memories. And, you know, that's a gift to have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you also, you know, I get a lot of people who listen to the pod who want to be in the business, you know, technical, want to do what you do and that kind of stuff. I want to talk about directing for TV versus film. Your career has been interesting because a lot of the TV stuff you did was almost like doing films, like Band of Brothers. You know, you did some of those From the Earth to the Moon. That's some of my favorite stuff in those years. But it was like making little mini films, though, was it? Or did it feel like TV?
Sure. I mean, you know, look, you're collaborating with Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That feels like a film director versus what TV directing is really like, where I feel like a lot of TV directors sometimes can be in a box where they don't have the freedom that maybe a film director might have. Is that experience seem accurate or not accurate?
Really, you know, it comes down to the money, which money buys you time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, time buys you the opportunity just to go a little deeper in every aspect of the work. And also the money buys you stars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by two great actors. You know, I've been fortunate enough to, you know, work with some incredible casts over the years, and we want to watch, you know, great actors playing great parts. I mean, that's, you know, that's the difference. And I think I am, you know, look, I'm starting shooting a network TV pilot tomorrow, and the schedule isn't that much tighter than, say, shooting Jerry Marge. You know, Jerry Marge is with whatever 100-minute movie shot in 30 days. We're going to shoot a 44-minute pilot in 13 days. It's a very ambitious pilot.
Yeah.
Stars Jesse L. Martin. It's called The Irrational. Yeah, we're starting up here tomorrow. And the tone is different. Mm. You know, that's the thing. You know, doing pilots is like making a small movie. and half of them, you know, that's doing pilots. And that's, you know, I love that. I love, you know, taking something from nothing and creating something that might have a life. You know, the subsequent episodes, you are kind of in a box. You know, the major characters have been cast, the rhythms, the look, the style, everything has been set, and it's harder. I did get to work on, I did episodes of The Morning Show, and that was, again, a more cinematic movie-like experience, you know, working with big movie stars, a healthier budget, more time. You know, because you have more time, you can be more ambitious about the style that goes into the filmmaking. So I think, except for the Marvel movies and the, you know, the Pixar movies and the movies that we're going to, that are going to continue to go to the big screen, there's so much extraordinary work being done for television.
Yeah, there really is.
You know, so it's a new hybrid form where I don't think you can, it's, you know, I don't think it's TV. It's obviously not a movie in the conventional sense, but there's a joke I just saw in the trailer for Irma Vep that's on HBO, and the director's pitching the show, and it's like, says, you know, someone calls it a series. He goes, it's not a series. It's just a very long movie. And that's kind of what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a lot. And I think it's great. You know, I mean, for some of them, sometimes it gets padded out, you know, wow, this could have been 2 hours, you know, but sometimes that taking the time, are there's these real wonderful qualities. I mean, the, you know, a show like The Crown going over years and years is absolutely brilliant. But then there are shows that are about, you know, topics that are familiar, like The Dropout, that, you know, you get to see performances and storytelling that wouldn't have been available if you had to fit it into 2 hours.
Yeah, I like this new, I'm a huge fan of, it's not a new form, but I think it has a new life. It's the limited series. Like Queen's Gambit, to me, it's almost like a long film, you know, because it's not, as you say, it's not really a series, you know, but you need to tell it. It needs time for that story to be told. And when it's done, it's done. It's not like it's open-ended, like there's a second season or something. It's a story, you know.
Although I'm sure they talked about it, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Right, where can we go?
They didn't expect it to be that big.
Maybe she plays backgammon also.
Backgammon, exactly. Yeah. The Queen's Crown, it's checkers now. Yeah. But I love that form. I think, you know, some people have lamented the loss of, you know, how versatile the theatrical movie is now. And it isn't as versatile as it used to be. It is more of the big movies, you know, and COVID plays a big part in that. But I think streaming has allowed movies like Jerry and Marge to be a movie, where without streaming, I don't know if that could be a movie today.
Right. No, we went for, you know, a period, you know, 5 years or so, where movies like Jerry March just were not getting made.
Yeah.
I mean, it was almost impossible. And, you know, unless it was somebody felt like, oh, I'm going to win an Oscar.
Right. There'd be a campaign behind it type of thing. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's something that's meant to just be entertaining and, you know, and sweet and make you feel good. I mean, the cost of marketing is so extraordinary. Yeah. And the pandemic is, that seems to have affected the audience, although Top Gun is upending everybody's expectations.
That.
So, yeah, it might be that, you know, wow, people are just dying to get back to the theater. So it's kind of fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the volatility in the world in which we play is fascinating.
Do you think people will return to the theaters? I mean, people have been predicting the demise of movies for years and years. Television was supposed to kill it. You know, internet was supposed to kill it. All these things were supposed to kill it. COVID almost did it, you know.
Yeah. But, right.
So who, I mean, to see the Cinerama Dome here in Los Angeles, which, you know, guys, Cinerama Dome is like a magical place as far as I'm concerned, you know. And to see that close is just ridiculous. So,
but yeah, I think people are going to go back.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think they just won't go back as, they won't go as often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're going to go for more rent style movies and the things that feel like, oh, I have to see it in the theater. I mean, I went to the movies as often as I could.
Yeah,
I mean,
me too.
Kids, it's like, you know, they're 20 and they go a handful of times a year. And they don't really make the distinction between watching something in a theater and watching something at home.
I know. It always exists. Yeah. There's always a lot of humanity in the projects that you do. You know, even when I mentioned those films, even though you're part of Earth to the Moon, Banner Brothers, that kind of stuff. But
you know, you're still in that. But to see even the work that you've done, that you choose to do, like Marley and Me, are you consciously looking for that type of thing? Because it comes through in all of your work.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm consciously looking for, you know, for movies that I can, that I, where I really personally relate to the characters. So, and you'd say, well, where are you in Devil Wears Prada? Well, I was, you know, a young person graduating college, moving to New York for my first job. And you know, that has a universal quality. And Marley and Me was, you know, was John Grogan's life, but it was extremely autobiographical. I mean, I wrote, you know, I worked on the script. I would do a lot of my thinking, you know, outside in the backyard, hosing down dog poop. I was a guy with, you know, a beautiful wife and two little kids and six or seven dogs at home. So, you know, that was my life also. So I've made a movie about birdwatching, made a movie about opera singers, but, you know, so it's not always, there's not always a direct connection, but there's a sense of the character that I really connect to. And, you know, it's a very often it's this idea about what makes an extraordinary life and how do I get, who are the people who get from here to there, and what does it take and what do you give up? You know, years ago, I had an idea for a magazine. It was going to be called Obit Magazine. It was about, obviously, people who died. But then I pitched it to my dad, and he gave it to the editor of New York Times Magazine at the time. And they said, well, it's not like going to be a whole magazine, but we'll do an issue. And so now, every year for the last, whatever, 25 years, they've done Lives Well Lived. And it's an appreciation of, you know, not just people who are accomplished, and some, a lot of them are famous, of course, but it's, there's so many people that we don't know about or who are, and that, I don't know, that's always, I've always been drawn to, like, what is it? Not that it makes us remembered, but just where's the balance between work and life and family and a commitment to things outside your own sphere? And what's important? That's not, very little of that actually ends up in the movies, but that's the question that I'm always asking myself. And I think that's the question the characters are striving to discover. And, you know, that's the thing about Jerry March. It's, you know, I worked all these years at Kellogg's and now I'm retired. And, you know, Jerry is he literally asked himself, I feel like I missed it. He says, you know, that's the most terrifying feeling I think that all of us can have as we get older is, wait, did I blow it? You know, because you go for a long time and you think you always have time, you know, and then somewhere along the way, you know, your friends start kicking it and you go, whoa, I don't have as much time as I thought. And if you're wise, lucky, you reorient yourself a little bit and you do find something new. And maybe you get, as Jerry March do, you get a new adventure.
Do you think people, because of the pandemic and, you know, the stuff we're going through now, we got a war and all that stuff, do you think people are reexamining what it is to the phrase, a life well lived? We're kind of going through that as a culture.
Yes, for sure. I think you see that in, you know, the number of people who quit their jobs in the pandemic, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Right? Yeah.
So you see that. So there's that. All these people go, you know, take this job and shove it literally. And, you know, I'm going to find something that's more fulfilling or I'm not going to work at all. There's all these people who just, I'm not going to the office. I'll work, but I'm not going to the office.
Right.
My life is better and more fulfilling. And I spend more, you know, why am I spending whatever, an hour on the train or an hour in my car each way when I could be here, you know, with my family or with my dog or, you know, or literally don't even have to be in the city. You know, I could be skiing this afternoon or surfing. So, I think people are saying we've been doing it all wrong for a long time.
And
the pandemic was an excuse to sort things out. I think it's all going to, there's an equilibrium and we'll get back to some semblance that's probably closer to the way things were before. But it's all good. You know, I think all that, all the examination, I mean, for years we've heard that, boy, the Europeans got it right. You know, that whatever the French, they work 4 days a week. They have, they take, you know, 10 weeks of vacation. It's all paid, they have, you know, all this leave, they, you know, they get there, they retire early. And we're thinking like, they're just lazy. And you, no, that's not it. But they realize like there's something more. There are more important things than making money or, you know, building a career. And the flip side is I have great respect for the people who, you know, really go the extra mile in their commitment to changing the world or just doing something excellent. You know, that was my great appreciation for Anna Wintour. That movie of Devil Wears Prada is a love story to Anna Wintour. Sure. No one quite appreciates that, but it's a salute to someone who says, no, you know, excellence is the only thing I care about. And everything else, you know, being socially pleasant is irrelevant to me. You know, my early hero in sports was John McEnroe. I just cared that he was great. I didn't care that, you know, he behaved like a jerk sometimes. You know, we even, like, you see that today. I mean, you see that, I mean, somehow we all still love Tiger Woods, you know, and the guy's got the most checkered personal history in the history of sports. But fortunately, he's come out the other side and seems like a great guy now. But our affection for him is completely undiminished by everything because of his excellence. And I, you know, and so I appreciated that also. But, you know, Tiger does seem to be someone who, like the rest of us now, has, through all his travails and traumas, has realized a better way to live his life.
And I think we do tend to forgive people who are raising the bar, even if they fall short, you know, who are going after something worthwhile, even if they have flaws and that type of thing. We're less forgiving. We were talking about this whole golf thing that's happening in the world. You know, people who seem to take shortcuts, even if it looks like they're winning with that shortcut, there's a small runway of appreciation for that. That runway runs out really quick, I feel.
I think that's very perceptive. Yeah, I think you're right. You know, I'm a fan of Elon Musk. I think he's, you know, I think what he does is remarkable. I hate his politics. I hate
He's a bit crazy. Yeah, he's definitely crazy. Yeah.
And so I'm like crazy genius. Divided. Like, you know, my wife is laying down the law. No Teslas for you, buddy.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yes.
And I'm kind of crestfallen. But
I'm like, keep doing SpaceX, Elon. Just focus on SpaceX is what I think of Elon. Like, stay away from Twitter. Stay far away from Twitter. Just keep making rockets. Right. Is how I look at
rockets
it.
And tunnels. I appreciate the tunnels too.
Yes, the tunnel. Yes. Well, that's great, David. It's so great speaking to you. Last thing, any pivots for you at this point in your life? Do you see you want to keep doing this, or do you have any pivots in mind, or something else you also want to do, or figure out, or that type of thing?
I mean, I think I'm just, you're lucky to do what I do. And I'm always looking to see, like, there's some way to reinvent the wheel a little bit. And years ago, I created a couple of TV shows that seemed to be new, you know, to have take a new approach to storytelling. And I'm always looking to do that. That's all, you know, and I don't know if I still have it in me, but I keep trying. So still in the world of, you know, making television or making films, but maybe finding a form. The style of a show created years ago called Grapevine was, you know, people talking to camera, was sort of a documentary style, but up a notch, and completely failed as a TV show, but it got a lot of attention and it helped launch my directing career. And, you know, after there was a flood of, you know, single camera shows after that, and people talking to camera and making the fourth wall and all that. So, and then, you know, I mentioned I won an Oscar for this short film that I made with Maurice in the 90s. And again, you know, it just had a different format. It was never going to survive on television at the time.
Right.
And now, of course, there's this great open playing field in television. And there's now so much stuff out there that it's really hard to say, okay, this is inventive. This is new. This I haven't seen before.
Right.
You know, I'm going to keep trying, you know, that's it. And, you know, the pivot will be, you know, when one day I hope to just be a caddy for my son on the PGA Tour.
That would be awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I've always have thought that way too, with the projects that I've done. Even when I did Bernie Mac show, like, most of the stuff was multicam, you know, and I kind of took my cue from what I was observing in reality at the time, which was just starting to take off.
Exactly. Yeah.
When I was even looking at going back to French New Wave and what, you know, some of them were doing back then and bringing that back to television, that feel that, you know, like in Breathless, you know, you feel like you're experiencing it as it's happening type of feel, you know, those type of
of movies and that type of thing. And I've always looked to break the form when I'm writing, you know, if I can't, if there's something in there, or just do the story in a way that's unexpected, that's changing up the rhythm, or, you know, keeping the audience off balance in a good way, you know.
What's interesting, obviously, in Hollywood now is there's this sort of cultural boundaries. So only certain people can write about certain things and or play certain parts, right? So suddenly I find myself going, all right, well, now I got to write for 60-year-old white guys.
Yes, finally! Finally, there's somebody there to do
there
that.
There you go.
Thank you, David.
But that's all, you know, I feel like at some point that's all I'm allowed to do. You know, there's, I come in and break some boundaries and you go, you know, who's your collaborator? Who else is in on this? So it's a fascinating time.
You sneak it in through collaboration. That's how you do
it. No, I think that's exactly right. So, you know, but it, you know, look, the change is essential and long overdue. And I, you know, I'm thrilled that it's happening and it is happening. I don't know if you perceive it, but I really do feel like,
oh, for sure.
I feel like the playing field is changing in all the best ways.
I think it's exciting because whenever you have a flood of new voices and new approaches to thing, it ultimately changes things in an exciting way. If you have a creative mind and you're looking to push boundaries and that sort of thing, and you love that challenge, it's tougher if you're just doing a particular thing that you want to keep doing the same way all the time,
right.
You know, that's a little tougher because times just change,
sure.
You know, and what are you going to do? I mean, there's a certain expiration date for everybody, you know?
Yeah.
So I always said, I'd like to do a lot of different things so I could be a moving target in terms of the business, you know? So it's like, Larry, we don't really need writers your age anymore. Sorry, I'm an actor right now.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, like, thank God you're an actor. You were a great actor. And
thank you. As I said
to you many times on the set, you should be acting more.
I've taken your advice in that, by the way, and I intend to do that. I really listened. I took that to heart when you said that. And I'm actually one of my... you could call it a pivot, is I'm going to be doing more of that now.
You know? I mean, it takes a certain confidence, but it's also just an understanding that there's an audience and people really enjoy watching you and you really make people laugh.
Yay. And laugh, guys, at Jerry and Marge Go Large, Paramount Plus, directed by the great David Franco, brings humanity and laughs and everything to everything that he does. David, it was so great not only working with you, but having you here on Black in the Air. Thanks so much, my friend, for coming by.
It was my enormous pleasure, Larry. Thank you so much.
And we got to get together, have a drink, and talk about Phil Mickelson one of these days. Yeah.
Definitely. I'll be in L.A. in a month or so, and we'll play some golf and talk about Phil.
And you're in Miami, right?
I live in Miami and I'm currently in Vancouver.
Oh,
where we're
Vancouver.
Shooting this pilot.
Oh, you're shooting the pilot. That's right. You're starting that. All right. Let me know when you're done with the pilot. Let's do that for sure. Absolutely.
Great.
Thanks, everybody.
All right.